Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Ignatius of The Washington Post is a columnist whose beat is national security and intelligence. He's also the author of 7 novels, thrillers, fictional takes on real-life intrigue and confusion and paranoia in the Middle East, the D.C. Beltway, the War on Terror, and more. His latest book takes on the hottest geopolitical story today, Iran and its nuclear program. This hour on Point, The Washington Post's David Ignatius on the facts and fictions that surround Iran and American perspectives on Iran. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius. He was the Wall Street Journal's Middle East correspondent way back 80 to 83, covering wars in Lebanon and Iraq, became the Journal's chief diplomatic correspondent, moved to the Washington Post, and was the paper's foreign editor from 90 to 92, oversaw the paper's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. After a stint as executive editor of the International Herald Tribune in Paris, he returned to the Post. He's now associate editor, writes an award-winning column on global politics, economics, and international affairs. He's also written 7 novels. Body of Lies was turned into a movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe. His new thriller, a real page-turner about Iranian nuclear weapons programs, spies, moles, and traitors, is called The Increment. David Ignatius, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for that.
Of course, your publishers love the rip from the headlines angle here, and it couldn't be more true. Iran and its nuclear program all over Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to the United States, all over the headlines right now. I want to ask you just simply, though, your book opens with an Iranian nuclear scientist sort of dropping a dime via the homepage of the CIA, and I meant to check it out before I came here, but is there really a little prompt at the bottom of the CIA homepage online that says, contact us? Is a window for all this?
If your listeners want to go to CIA.gov, they will find, if they look carefully, an invitation to commit treason that is addressed to foreign visitors to that website. The people who send information have come to be known at the agency as virtual walk-ins, like the old walk-ins who would come into an American embassy or consulate around the world with secrets and be debriefed in a hurry. Today, this can be done electronically. And I'm told that people from all over the world, China, Russia, maybe even Iran, have used this avenue of approach, and it was one of the things I wanted to play with in this novel.
An invitation to commit treason, language from the book, it's provocative. The book itself provocative. You get a very familiar dynamic going where information comes in about Iran's nuclear program. The old pro at the CIA is skeptical, really wants to know more, really wants to understand, but there's a party at the White House that more or less really wants to go to war and is looking for any reason to do it. And boom, you're off to the races on many fronts there, David.
Well, Tom, the character at the CIA who receives this information, whose name is Harry Pappas, is an example of what I think is real at the agency, which is that people who were part of the rush to war in Iraq, who were pushed to provide intelligence, often against their better judgment, who went along sometimes skeptically, reluctantly, are determined not to do it again. And that's what Harry feels as he suddenly gets caught with this new information that comes in over the transom electronically, in the way that the White House takes it and suddenly is making it a pretext for war. And Harry, having been through it once before, and indeed having lost his own son, who was a Marine in Iraq, is determined not to repeat this mistake. And the book follows his efforts to understand what this information means, his efforts to keep faith with the young Iranian scientist who's providing it, and finally the way in which he's pushed into what in nominal terms would be called betrayal, to do what he thinks is right.
On his side, as the young scientist is engaged from Iran in a betrayal of his own, I mean, one of the things that kind of stunned me here in your portrayal, and this is a thriller, this is fiction, but you cover intelligence all the time, is how the sort of dropped dime from Tehran with very little on it in terms of signature or authorship. It could be anybody. It could be, it could be just tomfoolery, I suppose. It gets into the intelligence stream and right up to the President of the United States in fairly short order. We'll talk a lot about the book, but when you know it rides alongside real life, David, is it that short a trip from a kind of a blind drop dime to the Oval Office in real life?
All you have to do is look back at Iraq and what happened and the way in which very fragmentary and unreliable bits of information suddenly were rocketed to the vice president and the president and became a basis for our going to war, to know that this can happen. There's a political mood, a political ground on which intelligence lands, and it can suddenly take root and grow to monstrous size if there's a political will to believe. And that's what Harry, my intelligence officer, is trying to slow down. He keeps saying, do we really understand what this means? Do we even know where it's coming from? Let's find the person. Let's debrief the person. Let's understand what this intelligence is trying to tell us. And he finally insists on that, really overruling the guidance he's getting from the White House, which is in a rush to war. I hope we don't find ourselves in this situation with Iran, where suddenly again we're in a rush to war. But it could happen. You could get a piece of information next week that would seem so decisive in showing that the Iranian nuclear program was further along than we'd thought, that there would be a cry that we need to act now. We need to strike the Iranian nuclear program before this becomes a bomb. You asked, is this close to life? It could quickly. It's not today, but next week maybe.
You draw a lot in the increment from your closeness to the American intelligence community. You also draw from time contemplating and visiting Iran, Tehran. You've got a line in here where you talk about he who drops the dime sort of having a secret locked inside other secrets, and you say this was the Persian way. This was a land where it was bad manners to speak plainly. It was too forward, too disrespectful, sort of secrets within secrets. Is that Orientalism? Is that making something exotic of a country where people brush their teeth every day and put their pants on every day? Or is that really what intelligence community, what anthropologists have found of Iran?
Well, Iranians obviously are human beings like any other in some fundamental ways, but there are cultural facts that the Iranians have a powerful culture that is part of everything that they do. And I think that this is a culture in which it's sometimes impolite to be truthful and blunt in the way that we Americans are. Iranians kind of like to bend around the corner a little bit more. In my experience with them in Iran when I visited there in 2006, I'm told, I don't know that this is for sure, but I'm told that the CIA, in dealing with Iranians over many, many years, has had trouble using the lie detector, which is a typical instrument, the polygraph that the CIA uses when it's got an agent and wants to be sure about the agent's bona fides, because people in this culture become so comfortable with shading the truth, because being totally truthful is impolite. It's being honest that would raise a stress indicator, I've been told by some in the agency. Anyway, I this is a novel, so it's not a work of anthropology.
But did you feel that when you were last in Tehran, in the streets, in your conversations? I mean, there are many countries where conversations don't necessarily have the same bluntness of American conversations, though we have our own ways of veiling. But did you feel it when you were in Tehran?
Well, there is a politeness that pervades interactions. If you sometimes ask what something costs, you'll be told, nothing at all. The person doesn't mean that he doesn't want to be paid. If you get in a taxi, sometimes people will say that. It's starting a kind of ritual of bargaining. So, I wouldn't charge you anything for this, dear visitor. And then we end up negotiating the price. I think that we have been cut off as a country from Iran for so long that as we move toward engagement with Iran, as President Obama wants to do, a real challenge for us is to understand the culture better, so that in the negotiation we'll understand the signals. We'll do that effectively. I know that that's something that at the State Department and the NSC people are talking about. How do we get that kind of experience? There's discussion. Should we run simulations where we have Iranian Americans and we'll sit down with American negotiators in quotation marks, try to see what a negotiation is like with these cultural factors fed in.
We're going to come back with David Ignatius. His new thriller is The Increment. It's pulled right out of the world of Iran, nuclear programs, intelligence, diplomacy, the intersection of all of those, just across the line in fiction land. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about intrigue over Iran in the latest fiction from Washington Post columnist David Ignatius. David, I wish you'd give us a sense of the background of this young Iranian scientist who's been in your book, The Increment, educated some in Germany, about what kind of intelligence he shares via, initially, the CIA's open website with U.S. intelligence, and what kind of background he has that might have led him to this betrayal of the regime in Tehran.
Tom, I think the most important part of his story, his backstory, is, as we often say, is his relationship with his father, who was very strongly against the regime of the Shah and believed in the Iranian Revolution of 1979, but found himself and his ideals betrayed by that revolution, and by the time he died, was sick of it, and really made his son promise that he would stay separate from the regime. And that weighs on the son as a heavy burden, and I think is the most powerful motivation in the end for him to betray his country, to share secrets of the nuclear program in which he's working. He's a young physicist. As you said, he's been trained in Germany. A crisis in his life leads into this moment in which he, again to use your phrase, drops a dime, in which he begins to send information out electronically to the CIA, really trying to keep faith, obviously not with his country, but with his father and with who he believes he is himself.
This is a real strand of tension in Iran, not just in the thriller. There's a bit I wish you might read, David, early on in the book that describes some of this life, this father-son relationship, even a little bit of poetry from I think, an actual Iranian poem woven into your text. Could you set it up and read a bit for us?
This is a passage early in the book, Tom, in which I'm trying to explain what my character, whose name is Karim, is really all about. The young man had been reading the night before from a book of poems by Simin Behbahani, an Iranian woman who was his nation's most beloved modern writer. His father claimed he had known her when he was a professor at Tehran University and she was a student, and maybe it was true. Like his father, Behbahani had never left Iran for long, even in the worst days, but there was in her poems an anguish and a yearning for escape. The young man had left the volume open beside his bed to a poem called My Country, I Will Build You Again, and now in the morning he read the words again. My country, I will build you again, if need be, with bricks made from my life. I will build columns to support your roof, if need be, with my bones. I will inhale again the perfume of flowers favored by your youth. I will wash again the blood off your body with torrents of my tears. It should not only be the poets who tell the truth, the young man thought. The Islamic Republic of Iran was not his country. He had secretly become one of the Doshmand, the enemy. He had wanted to disappear into the shadows of his work and enjoy his privileges like any other hypocrite, But that had become impossible. That was what frightened him. He could not escape from himself. His father had told him that he must listen to his own voice and not to those who impiously claimed to speak for God. He had said it the night before he died, and the scientist had answered, "Yes, Baba, I understand," which made it a promise. He didn't want to be a betrayer, but the promise was already inside him. It had taken root. It was crowding out the other voices so that he heard only his own. When he awoke that morning, he had the nub of a plan. He would drop a pebble into the pond. That was all. The pebble would be information, the smallest bit of the truth about what he was doing in his laboratory. And then he would let the water ripple where it would. No one would see him do it or trace cause and effect. Something had come into his hand, and he would let it fall. That was what he thought was possible in the beginning.
David Ignatius, reading from his new novel, Thriller, The Increment, the young Iranian nuclear scientist. There's sort of a portrait of a betrayer before it's all over. His CIA counterpart on the other side of that dropped pebble gets involved in some betrayal himself of the U.S. government, or at least the White House. End of it. David, we've got a lot of people who want to drop a pebble here with you. Corey in Beaufort, South Carolina. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I'm actually half Persian. My father was born in Iran and came over to the U.S.
Uh-huh.
I was raised here, and I just wanted to comment. We were talking about the kind of extreme politeness that you can experience and whether or not it's sincere. And one thing that I've definitely observed growing up in a Persian culture is that there's something called tarofing, and it's actually a form of being extremely polite, you know, in order to kind of test the sincerity of the other person.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, if you were at my home and I offered you tea and you said no, I would actually probably ask you three or four more times, and you would say no each time, but each time expecting that I would ask you again, kind of to prove the sincerity that I really did want to offer you tea.
Right. How do you see that factoring into the big game here, Corey? Maybe even into international espionage and international relations?
Well, I think it's tough. What I've experienced is more on a family level. So within the international politics and whatnot, I think it makes it very difficult to interact if you don't know if they're testing your sincerity or if they're actually sincere. So I guess that's one way you could infer.
Yeah, Corey, thanks very much for that. I mean, of course, it's not unique to Iran. I remember, growing up in a rural American community where you never were prepared to accept pay from another farmer right off the bat for the work you'd done. You had to say no until they chased you down in press. It's not only Iranian culture. Let's get more on Iran. Matt, in Boston, you're on the air with David Ignatius.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I was born in Iran. I left when I was 10, about 25 years ago. And I fully agree with the point that was made about the politeness of Iranians as being a very strong part of the culture. The one part about this story that I may argue a bit about is the fact that Iranians, by nature, are very nationalistic, very proud people of their country.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of the government, you may absolutely hate the government and the politics there. I have a hard time believing that a scientist would go against his own country and reach out to the CIA to undermine, because at the end of the day, I think as an Iranian, it would be a very hard decision for me to do something against my own country.
Yeah, Matt, understood, and certainly David Ignatius doesn't make it look like an easy path, but what about it, David? Put it up against reality. You've got a guy who does make that passage for deep reasons. You began to read kind of in description of some of those, but does your portrayal here line up with what American intelligence has actually found coming out of Iran? As far as you know, have they ever found Iranian nuclear scientists who have been forthcoming to the point of, espionage, disloyalty about that country's nuclear program?
Well, the information in the National Intelligence Estimate that was published in December of last year, December of the year before, came from somewhere. Some of it, I'm sure, was obtained through technological means, but I suspect some of it came from human beings. I think that Iranians who don't like this regime, and there are many of them, may feel that by contacting the West, by sharing information, they are in fact serving their country and their country's interests as they understand them. Certainly, a visitor to Tehran is surprised by many things, but most of all for me was how freewheeling the debate is about the regime's policies. If you wander in the covered bazaar in Tehran, a magnificent marketplace, and just walk into people's stalls and begin talking to them with help from a translator, you'll find every shade of political opinion. This man will say, I think President Ahmadinejad is an idiot. He embarrasses our country. He's impolite. He's uncouth. The next stall, the man will love Ahmadinejad and denounce the Americans. It's a surprisingly open place. I think what one caller said, that Iranians are very nationalistic, that they believe in Iran and its destiny. I'm sure that's true, but in my experience, there are a lot of people who think the policies of the current regime are themselves a betrayal and that one should do something about it. On this question of the culture of politeness and the rituals of politeness, the Iranian Americans who called said it better than I could, but I'll just describe one experience I had in Tehran. I went to visit the editor of one of the hardest line Iranian newspapers called Kehan, and he was talking in very indignant language about the United States and how terrible it was. And in the course of our conversation, I mentioned that I was a novelist. And immediately his tone softened, and he was a student of Persian poetry himself, and he got a magnificent volume of Persian poetry that had been translated, just a great big, I mean, it would cost hundreds of dollars to buy in a store. And he said, here, I want you to have this. You're a writer, and I believe in writing. And so we went through this ritual in which he offered it three or four times. Yes. The truth was it was so heavy I couldn't carry it back in my suitcase.
Right. Right.
But he finally understood that I couldn't take it, but it was polite.
A show of respect to the realm of literature, I guess, ritual, but also a real show of respect. We should pivot for a second then and take us to the American side of this equation, where maybe no less than the Iranian side, as you present it, though with a different texture, there are many layers and conflicting kinds of agendas and perspectives, what levels of success coming to grips with reality. Give us a sense of the complexity on the U.S. side of this fictional interaction you set up as a real-life columnist in the increment.
Well, I think CIA officers struggle to be loyal to their presidents, loyal to the administration that they serve, but also loyal to their country in some deeper way. And I think that tension is often evident.
And those are not always the same thing.
They aren't always the same thing. Again, the searing example that we have in our minds is Iraq, where many of the intelligence professionals that I know knew that the case for war was weak and had doubts. If you go back and you look at now unclassified CIA intelligence reporting before the war, you will see clear warnings from CIA analysts of all the terrible things that happened in Iraq that they warned might come. And the administration was so upset when these warnings began to sneak out. The Paul Pilar, who was the top Middle East analyst, let slip at an off-the-record dinner some of his doubts a year or so later, and the White House was enraged. They thought this was complete. The CIA was out to get them because this man was telling the truth. He was saying this isn't going to work out. So these people, intelligence officers, always have this sort of dual loyalty. They're supposed to be loyal to the political leaders who were elected. Like military officers, they take civilian leadership, but they also need to be true to their profession. They need to be true to the facts as they see them, and that's led to some tormenting situations. And what I'm trying to imagine in this book is a CIA officer who says to himself, "I won't do it again. I won't let political pressure falsify my sense of what's really going on in the world." And so, as we said earlier, he's pushed more and more toward what we would call betrayal, because he won't lie for political leaders.
That's a tension I think the whole country can feel around this region, and certainly over the possibility of war with Iran, depending how that ever, God forbid, would unfold. Into this, you bring another very distinct element. It's right in your title, The Increment. That's not about U.S. intelligence at all, but allies, British intelligence, and their sort of very shadowy License to Kill outfit that has to operate sort of on our behalf in your fictional telling in Iran, because the U.S. presence there is so light. But that gets complicated in a hurry, too, David.
The Increment, from which I take the title of the book, is a real British special operations capability. It's a little bit like our Delta Force, but several notches up. I first heard about it from a former CIA officer who said, boy, the Brits have got something pretty cool. And then he proceeded to describe this unit that's loaned to British intelligence for missions as need be, that has the ability to move in and out of difficult places because it draws for its personnel on all of the nationalities that were once part of the British Empire. So it's got Pakistanis, Arabs, you name it, people from all over the world who can blend into the culture, who can travel invisibly. And it's said that this unit has inherited the 007 License to Kill. I couldn't give you a detailed account of what that means in real life because its operations are so secret. But I got fascinated by this idea. I said to a friend at one point, this is James Bond meets my beautiful laundrette,
yeah.
If you remember the
Hanif
Qureshi,
yeah,
story. Yeah. And that's sort of the way I play it out in the book. But it's the real-life basis for the Increment is fascinating. I'd love to know more, but it's an awfully hard subject to penetrate.
And maybe the real-life tensions that quickly emerge or hidden agendas, because these allies, the U.S. and U.K., in spite of the fact that we're calling on their, capability, I guess is an intel word, on the ground, the agendas in London and Washington are not the same in your telling.
Well, I've thought for years of writing a spy novel in which the recruitment takes place by Britain, and it's in a sense it's Britain on the other side of the ledger. We're so used to thinking of the Brits as interchangeable with us, the notion that it's really a separate country, sometimes with separate interests, rarely crosses our mind. I got interested in this initially, early in my career as a journalist, when I began looking at how British intelligence had operated in the United States in the 2 years before we went to war against Germany in 1939, 1940, 1941. British intelligence created a special capability in America.
David, hold the thought, David. We've got to go to a break here. Sorry to break in. We've got an Iranian rapper to go out of this segment on. A little sound of Iran right now. David Ignatius, new thriller is The Increment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about intrigue over Iran in the latest fiction from Washington Post columnist David Ignatius. It's called The Increment. And David, you were talking about U.S. and U.K. at odds in history, certainly in your book, not so subtly always, but on the eve of World War II.
Well, as I was saying, Tom, right before World War II, the British created something that was called British Security Cooperation, BSC, that operated in the United States. And it was basically a covert action to try to push the U.S. into war. At that time, the U.S. still had a lot of isolationist sentiment. The Brits set out to undermine that, so they went into congressional districts. They attacked candidates who they thought would oppose U.S. intervention in the war. They just took them down. It was one of the most effective covert actions, I think, in modern history. The British, their very existence was at stake. So it's a fascinating chapter. What it tells us is that as close as these two countries are, there are times when their interests are different and the British are capable of acting with great subtlety and sometimes deviousness to achieve what they want.
Friends can manipulate each other just as well, maybe better, than foes. Let's get a call from Rob in Salem, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on the air with David Ignatius.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just had two quick points. I'm an Iranian-American, and number one, I just wanted to contest what the previous Iranian-American caller suggested by kind of extrapolating from his own sort of personal feelings and projecting it onto all Iranians. I left Iran, much closer to right now than our friend who called earlier. And what I would say is I would actually agree with David Moore that Iranians are very much more and more capable of separating, you know, Iran as a national entity from the Islamic Republic as a political entity that they despise. And I think that feeling is very much widespread. And the second point that I had is more about the broader geopolitical question, and I'd love to get David's thoughts on this. I worry, as an Iranian-American who considers himself an opponent of this regime, that, you know, this focus on the nuclear dossier that's just not going away, and
yes,
not that I'm saying it's not a serious issue, mm-hmm, is beginning to sort of take away the West's attention from the more important question, I would say, of democratization, secularization, and all those processes that could lead to an Iran that wouldn't be a concern for the West anymore in the way that it has been. It's, you know, a secure Israel, and a safe democratic Iran, and I just worry that the Obama administration in particular would make a compromise that would lead to democratization being taken off the table. I'll take my answer off here.
Rob, you're good. David Ignatius, what do you say?
Well, it's a fascinating set of comments. I think the Obama administration's answer would be that as we engage Iran, as we move away from this culture of confrontation here and there, and there's greater openness, that the likelihood of political change inside Iran will grow, that the regime almost depends on this sense of perpetual crisis with the U.S. to mobilize the country. It's sort of like Castro's Cuba.
So when you take down the temperature over nukes, change is more or less likely?
Well, I don't think that it's possible to take the temperature on nukes down to the point that's not an issue. I think there are just too many countries that feel that Iranian possession of nuclear weapons, given this regime and what it's said about Israel, but not about the region in general, is unacceptable. We have to remember there have been four Security Council resolutions passed condemning the Iranian nuclear program. Three sets of sanctions. It's not that this is just the U.S. and Israel. I think the Russians are deeply, genuinely concerned about the behavior of a nuclear Iran. And Iran has to understand that to get what it wants, which is validation of its rise to be a significant regional power, it's going to have to give up something. It can't have it all. The Iranians, I think, have gotten very cocky. If you look at their behavior through Hezbollah, their proxy in Lebanon, if you look at their behavior through Hamas, their proxy in the Palestinian dispute, you know, they think they're on a roll. And one challenge for Obama is to engage them, but at the same time make clear that there are red lines on Iranian behavior. You can't have it all in this world. Nobody can.
But what about Rob's?
So that's really...
Rob's called to kind of try to reach around the nuclear issue to address culture itself, maybe the democratic impulse there, maybe the disillusionment in parts with the Islamic Republic.
Well, Iranians have to do that themselves. One thing that I've been struck by when I was there and since trying to keep up with Iranian debates is how strong civil society is in Iran. There is a strong dissident movement. We'll see in these elections. Iran has elections starting June 12. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that at the end of that process, Ahmadinejad is going to lose, in part because he's embarrassed Iranians with some of his outrageous anti-Semitic, anti-Holocaust remarks, also his inability to deal with the imploding Iranian economy.
And accept the loss and be gone.
Well, he represents a faction that isn't going to disappear overnight.
Right,
but
of course.
Again, I think the point for Americans is Iranians have to do this. It's their country. They care passionately about it. The forces of change in Iran are so strong. And I think sometimes when we try to get in there and stir the pot, as we did with the $75 million that was appropriated during the Bush administration to support these groups, it ends up making life harder for them. It accomplishes very little good and a lot of difficulty. And how can I say it other than this, to say that I have a lot of confidence that smart young Iranians are going to find ways to make this a more acceptable and democratic country.
Let's go to Sandy in Wareham, Massachusetts. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have two questions. My first question relates to Israel. Isn't most of the intelligence that we get about Iran filtered through Israel? And is Israel worked into this novel? And then the second question is, are you not worried that these novels might be feeding this current paranoia that we have about Iran and pushing the case for war in sort of a backhanded way, because you're sort of saying that the arguments that we've used thus far, i.e., we've made the mistake of believing our intelligence too glibly, and now maybe we're going to go the other extreme, and so it might push us back towards believing our intelligence. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure, especially when the novelist is also a real-world columnist in the newspaper right in the middle of Washington. David, how about those points, Israel and paranoia being primed even by fiction?
Good questions. The United States has its own intelligence about Iran. I think it'd be wrong to say it's fed through Israel. Certainly, American and Israeli analysts are talking all the time about the Iranian issue, but they have come to significantly different judgments over time about many issues. The U.S. thinks that the Iranians stopped their weaponization program in 2003. The Israelis think it continues. The Israelis think that the Iranians could rush to complete a bomb within, the latest estimate I've heard is 8 to 12 months. The U.S. thinks it's really more still like 2 or 3 years. So they're quite different judgments that are brought to bear. Israel doesn't play a significant role in this novel. This is really about the CIA, its judgments, and its decisions about what to do, which I think, in truth, if when it comes down to it, America's going to make up its own mind about Iran as close as it is to Israel. Finally, will this feed paranoia about the Iranian nuclear program? You'd have to read the book, but I'd be surprised if anybody at the end of this story doesn't come away thinking that it's important to be skeptical about information and assertions that are made about Iran. But it's one of those where I really do want to say you got to read the book.
Do you think, just to try and get to Sandy's question, you've got the UK in here as sort of toying with American intentions and understandings here. Do you think Israel is any more or less likely to engage in that kind of, I mean, every country has its own interests, right? In that kind of manipulation, I guess, you've got the UK doing here.
There's no question that Israel seeks to influence the U.S. debate in all kinds of different ways and has had a lot of success at that over time. One thing that's striking about the Obama administration is it's determined to make up its own mind about these questions. We have Benjamin Netanyahu, the new Israeli prime minister, visiting Washington this week.
2 days.
And I think you're going to see pretty strong statements of independent U.S. policy on the Palestinian issue. We're going to be really pushing him well beyond his comfort level, beyond the push that I think we've seen from any U.S. administration over time. Obama really wants to do something on this. And I think that some differences about Iran will become apparent during this visit, too. So we're entering a new and somewhat different period in the U.S.-Israel relationship in which there's going to be more overt disagreement and even tension between the two countries.
What about on the issue of a possible intervention in Iran? We've read in recent days that the Obama administration has, like the Bush administration before, been very explicit in saying, no, Israel, you don't go there until, you know, we're all on board together. Do you think that is that a line that holds?
I've written that in my column, Tom, that we have said to Israel that we do not think this is the time for hostilities against Iran. And there has been a reporting recently that during the visit he made to Israel, our CIA director, Leon Panetta, said to the Israelis that very specifically, we think military action is unwise. It's against Israel's interests. It's against U.S. interests. And I think what has come out of that is a commitment by Israel that it will not act unilaterally, that it will consult with the U.S., and that implies, since we feel strongly this is unwise now, that the Israelis will hold off. But we'll have to see. Israel's obviously going to reserve its right to act independently if it feels it has to act.
Let's go to Stanton, Virginia, and Alan. Alan, you're on the air with David Ignatius.
Thank you. Mr. Ignatius, I'm very pleased to be speaking with you personally. You once answered a note that I sent you about one of your columns, which I appreciated. But my question has to do with your new book and the current controversy over Congressman Pelosi's comment about the CIA. I'm wondering if you think that the attitude of the character in your book, who is determined now never to hedge on the intel that comes out of the CIA, if that attitude is somewhat permeating the current CIA?
Well, I think that Panetta is leading an organization that wants to be more professional, that feels that it was pushed to support a case for war in Iraq that it didn't fully believe in. And I think from the top down, there is a sense that that was wrong, that the CIA has to be professional. They try to follow orders. That they're supposed to do that. But I think that there's more and more resistance. What I think Panetta has done with Speaker Nancy Pelosi is try to stand up for the professionalism of the CIA. When she says, I was lied to by the CIA, I was misled, Panetta has looked at the record. He thinks that's not true. He clearly thinks that Pelosi is trying to protect herself politically by making the CIA the villain here, the scapegoat. And so he said he thinks that's wrong. And I have a feeling that he has backing to do that from the Obama White House. We haven't written much about this side of the Pelosi CIA story, but I have to think, looking between the lines, that Obama is saying to a member of his cabinet, Leon Panetta, stand up for your agency, even if that's at the cost of a very prominent Democratic political leader.
When Panetta, of course, is a long-time, big-time Democrat himself.
Well, he comes out of the House. You know, he's a California House member. I mean, you know, he's in the same tradition as Nancy Pelosi. It's really a fascinating confrontation over the last week. Like a lot of people, I'm kind of scratching my head as I look at how far out on a limb the House Speaker has put herself. I don't know quite why she's done that. And I have a feeling that she may end up regretting it.
But do you see irony here in that those who pushed the CIA to make the very judgment calls that it now so regrets are sort of pushed out of the hot seat by Nancy Pelosi being pushed into it or sitting down there herself?
They're not pushed very far out of the hot seat. You know, I think the country, look, we just had a national referendum on these issues, and the Republicans got clobbered.
I.e. the presidential election.
The presidential election and the congressional elections. The Republican Party is unpopular and getting more so because people are fed up with these policies, and I think it's regrettable that Cheney is adopting a very divisive line in criticizing the new president, the new administration. I think that Obama has more credibility with the country as he said in various ways last week. I am commander in chief. My responsibility is to help protect our soldiers overseas. So, if this question of release of pictures and my commanders say that they'll put our troops at greater risk, I'm not going to do it. And on this question of the CIA, allowing his CIA director to directly rebut the top Democrat in Congress, again, I think was Obama trying to say, I'm the commander in chief. I'm the president of all the people. I'm the president of the people who didn't vote for me as much as I'm the president of the people who did vote for me. And I think that's how he becomes a stronger and stronger president.
The book's a very good read, lots of subtlety, but a bottom line many callers have asked for just in the half minute we have before you go, David. How do you see the odds of war or peace with Iran standing now?
I think that the U.S. has no intention, desire to go to war with Iran, and I think Israel is increasingly prepared to step back during a period of negotiation. And the Obama administration is sincere, I think, in its outstretched hand, and it's up to the Iranians now to decide whether they're going to shake that hand or walk away from it. If they walk away from it and are determined to continue with their program, they're going to have a lot of problems with that, and you hope it doesn't lead to war, but there are going to be a lot of problems.
David Ignatius takes us into many veils and nuances of this relationship in a real thriller, The Increment, his latest novel. He joined us today from Washington. David, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks for the new
great
book.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. David Ignatius. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. کشیده سر به خورشید غریب و بی عبوره به تنها تکیگاهی